is a bit tricky. We have Justice Kadish in Carson City, Justice Herndon and myself down here. This is the time and date set for oral argument in Lytle versus September Trust. And we're allotting 17 minutes per side, with the first 2 minutes being us being quiet so that the attorneys can speak without interruption. The clock will show. I don't know if it's showing on the center on the podium or not, but it's certainly showing on the video. So keep track of your time. Mr. Smith, do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal? Okay, very well. You may begin when you're ready.
I'm sorry, this is Julie. Could you tell me how much time he asked for?
5 minutes, Julie.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Herndon, Justice Pickering, Justice Kadish. May it please the court. Abe Smith for appellant. By the way, you are welcome to interrupt me during these 2 minutes. My goal here is to answer your questions, not to give an exegesis on reasonable hourly rates. But with that said, I'll get started. In law school, they tell you to start with the text. And then after you've exhausted your textual arguments, then you move on to public policy. Here, though, I'm going to switch it around. I'm actually going to start with policy, and then we'll get to the text of the relevant statute. The question really is, when the Lytles are willing to pay the property owners the highest fee their attorneys have ever charged, the only fees incurred here, what policy is served by awarding a more than 40% windfall to the parties based on the fiction that partners who have never charged their client more than they did here are entitled to, in this case, a 60 to almost 80% markup. So let's talk briefly about the policies behind fee awards generally, and then we'll get into the specific policies underlying the contempt statute here, NRS 22.100, subsection 3. Under the American rule, parties generally bear their own attorney's fees. Costs, yes, those are shifted to the prevailing party, but in Nevada, as elsewhere in the country, unless there's a specific statute, contract, or other authority, the fees are borne by the party, and those generally aren't shifted. What that means is that fee shifting in itself is a kind of penalty. It's a default from the norm that the parties bear their own fees. And in every fee statute, at least the ones that we've analyzed here, if the fee awarded is more than a reasonable attorney fee, that amounts to a windfall. So you're no longer talking about the penalty that is inherent in awarding attorney's fees. You're talking about a pure windfall, a markup over a reasonable attorney's fee. Now, there are differences in different regimes, different policies at play. In some, such as Section 1988, there are questions of access to justice. In fact, there's a statute called the Equal Access to Justice Act that implicates some of these policies as well. And in those cases, there's a need to provide attorneys some assurance that even if they're representing impecunious clients or in public interest litigation, or they're representing their clients pro bono, the attorney will not be penalized for taking the case at that lower rate or for free. But in no case is a fee-shifting statute, as the Supreme Court said various times, including in Perdue versus Kenny A., a form of economic relief to improve the financial lot of attorneys. Nor is it a profit-making venture for litigants. For a fee to be reasonable, it must mimic the fee.
Mr. Smith, sorry, there's always a little bit of a delay when we're doing this remotely, so I apologize for that. So I guess my question is, what if, in this case, counsel for September Trust had been, you know, a pro bono counsel helping to represent that party, you know, brought on through the Legal Aid Center, just as a hypothetical, right? Would they be able to then seek attorney's fees based on what reasonable hourly rate in the community would be?
I think the answer is potentially. Now, I do want to get to the issue of the specific contempt statute here, but in general, yes, that would change the analysis under Miller versus Wilfong. A pro bono attorney is entitled If the relevant fee-shifting provision provides for a reasonable attorney's fee, then, of course, the fact that the litigant has not actually incurred that fee may not be a barrier if there was a circumstance such as a pro bono representation or reduced fee representation where the lodestar, the lodestar actually is necessary in that situation to look to something like a community rate or the rates that attorney generally charges to paying clients. And the reason for that is obviously in a pro bono representation, that's not a market transaction. There's not a freely negotiated rate between a willing buyer, the client, and a willing seller, the attorney, without duress. Plus, you have the added circumstance that there's not a situation where the client is actually paying for the fees as they go. And of course, there's no guarantee at the beginning of the representation that the fees incurred will actually be reimbursed, that there'll be a right of reimbursement. I consider those sort of the hallmarks of a free market transaction, the willing buyer, willing seller, so a free negotiation. And especially if the client is paying as they go, right? So this isn't just something like Chacon versus Litke, where it's like, well, we agree to this ethereal fee, but the client's never actually going to pay that because the client's only going to pay out of the ultimate recovery. And then third, that the negotiation occurs before there's a right to reimbursement. Again, that's a critical factor because if the attorney goes into this already knowing that there's a right to a fee, that affects the freedom with which the parties are negotiating. Here, of course, unlike a pro bono representation or even a reduced fee representation, this is actually a very ideal vehicle if we were in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. The case is very clean because we have all of those factors. We have a free market negotiation. There's no indication that the client or the attorney was under duress during this negotiation. And they, in fact, agreed to the highest rate that these attorneys ever charge any client. Right, and this is a private transaction. This isn't a nonprofit legal organization. These are the highest fees that they charge any client, and these clients actually agreed to pay as they go. So the firm was sending them invoices. The clients were paying those invoices, and at the time that they negotiated that fee, there was uncertainty as to whether those fees would ever be reimbursed. That would skew that market transaction.
So Mr. Smith, let me just ask one follow up then. Like, are you asking us to adopt a legal rule that would build in all those conditions that you were just identifying? Or are you saying it's just an abuse of discretion under the particular circumstances present here?
Well, it's certainly an abuse of discretion under the particular circumstances here because the facts are so clean. But I think I don't think you need to announce a new legal rule. I think this is already captured in the concept of the lodestar. Now, keep in mind that the lodestar was developed in Lindy Brothers from the Third Circuit, eventually adopted in Blum versus Stenson by the U.S. Supreme Court in the context of 1988, which, again, I promised I'd eventually get to NRS 22.100. But Section 1988, obviously, that just says a reasonable attorney fee. There's no requirement that fee be incurred. Nevertheless, the lodestar, this court in Schutte versus Beezer, numerous times has upheld the lodestar method as an appropriate method for calculating attorney's fees in various circumstances. But the key there is that the lodestar really, it creates a sort of simulacrum of free market conditions. And so the idea behind the lodestar is that, yes, we will consult a prevailing market rate. Keep in mind, it's not merely an average rate within the community. It takes into account the specific, let me grab the language from Cousy and Stenson. It's not just the average rate, but it's the prevailing market rate considering the fees charged by lawyers of reasonably comparable skill, experience, and reputation. So that's really what the lodestar, that's the direction or the instruction from the lodestar method. The question is then how do you implement that? What is a reasonable hourly rate under the lodestar method? And we've cited numerous cases, including Guzman and the Barrow versus Fault case that talk about the best evidence of what that reasonable hourly rate is if you have the attorney in the private market charging rates to clients. That is the best evidence of that attorney's prevailing market rate in that in the relevant market. Because as we know, lawyers aren't cookie cutters, aren't cookies cut from cookie cutters, I suppose. And so you have to keep in mind not only the individual experience of the lawyer, but the practice that they're engaged in, the structure of their fees. I think that's particularly salient in this case, because as the property owner's counsel admits in this case, they have a unique fee structure, that actually explains what appeared to Judge Williams to be a relatively low rate. And that fee structure includes, it's a blended rate across partners and associates, and they explicitly adopt what they call a collaborative model, where there are a lot of inter-office attorney conferences, and they say that they lack support staff, so they have the attorneys taking care of a lot of those support staff obligations. So it makes sense in a situation.
But does everybody get 265 in their contract?
Correct. At the very beginning, it was 260, okay. and then it increased to 265.
Can you address the incurred word in 22-100 and the significance you attach to that and how that would affect your answer to Justice Kadish's question about if these lawyers were appearing pro bono, what would you do?
Right. So in the contempt statute, there is a separate requirement in Detweiler. This court clarified that that's an independent element under 22-103. It's not merely reasonable fees, but it's reasonable fees incurred by the party as a result of the contempt. Now, of course, in Detweiler, the issue wasn't the hourly rate. The issue was the time and the fact that there was attorney time by some crazy law firm. It's our law firm that had sought fees that occurred that included fees from before the contempt and after the contempt, and this court was very clear that no, that verb incurred, and then the prepositional phrase as a result of the contempt, those impose a standalone obligation that limits what constitutes a reasonable fee, just in the way that if I were to draft a motion for summary judgment, and if I've drafted this motion many times, it takes me 2 hours because I'm able to rely on my prior research. If it would take another attorney 200 hours, I don't get to submit a fee application on the basis of, well, it would have taken another attorney in the community 200 hours, and so therefore you should actually mark my rate up 100 times.
But do you believe that the word incurred outside of Detweiler and in this case is a limit that it needs to be actually incurred?
Yes, I do. And the reason is, I think it also gets back to the policy reasons. In the case of contempt, generally we're not talking about the concerns that animated Section 1988 or some of these other public interest statutes, where the concern is attracting counsel, right? You have some people that they may have a meritorious case on an important issue of civil rights, but they're not going to be able to attract counsel because they can't afford counsel.
And so would you say that they see this beleaguered group of homeowners and they want to help them and they say, look, we're not going to charge you, but we will apply for fees in the event we prevail, and we believe we will. Do you think they would not have incurred fees so they couldn't get fees in that setting where they're representing them pro bono?
Well, I mean, there would have to be, if there were another basis for fees, but when we're specifically...
Not 22-100, you would say the incurred would prevent reimbursement of a pro bono lawyer?
I don't think you need to reach the issue here. I think there might be a circumstance where you could say that, well, in some sense, there has been a fee incurred. My problem, though, is with the language of the statute that says that the fee has to go to the party. And my concern would be it's not the goal, even under a regime like Miller versus Wilfong, that the party reap some kind of profit from the litigation. And obviously in Miller versus Wilfong, this court was willing to award a fee to Marshall Willick because he had incurred those costs to his practice. But if the question is if the fee is being awarded to the party, then I think that presents a more difficult issue, which is why you see a distinction, right, between the civil rights statutes like 1988, where the fee does go to the attorney versus something like a 22-100 where the fee explicitly goes to the party.
Okay. You want to reserve the balance of your time?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Wesley Smith, counsel for the respondents in this case. In all candor to the court, I think that I do need to say that this case could possibly be the least desirable type of case that an attorney has to argue before an appellate court, where we are incurring fees to argue about fees. Perhaps that's why in the Hensley versus Eckert case from the U.S. Supreme Court, they said that a fee-shifting determination should not result in a second major litigation. For that reason, I believe that this court announced in Brunzell that we will not substitute our opinion for that of the trial court, unless as a matter of law there has been an abuse of discretion. And then the court went further to say the value to be placed on the services rendered by counsel lies in the exercise of sound discretion by the trier of facts. Further, Your Honors, we believe that when we believed this court, when it said in the Chouette opinion in 2005, that the court could use any method to determine that is rationally designed to arrive at a reasonable fee, including expressly allowing the lodestar method as a method to determine that reasonable fee. I believe that the district court also believed that clear statement of law and applied the guiding legal principles under the lodestar case law. So what does the lodestar look like? How is it done? It's really a very simple formula, Your Honors. And I think it makes this case much easier than it appears from the lengthy briefs that have been submitted to the court. Quote, after a court has determined that attorney's fees are appropriate, it must then, one, multiply the number of hours reasonably spent by two, a reasonable hourly rate to reach what is termed the lodestar amount. And that comes from the Hearst versus Humana Health Insurance case from this court in 1989. Notice that the formula does not include any requirement that the court review the fee agreement between client and counsel, or any limitation that the reasonable hourly rate is unconditionally tied to the fee agreement between client and counsel, as has been advocated for here. And to be clear, I don't believe such a requirement would be a normal procedure. I've never had a single case where a court requested a copy of my fee agreement as part of a fee-shifting determination.
Well, what do you do with the text of NRS 22-103, which references, including without limitation, attorney's fees, and then I would emphasize this, incurred by the party as a result of the contempt? To me, that language is different from other fee authorization statutes in that it uses the word incurred, some others do, but it also uses incurred by the party and then as a result of the contempt. And Detweiler kind of addressed that as a result of the contempt, but the incurred by the party seems to me that arguably expressing a policy that when you're getting into one party enforcing an order against another and seeking contempt, you just want to be done with it. And whatever the contractual relationship is, that is what should happen. And there should not be, we should not be incentivizing, as you said at the beginning, attorney's fees over attorney's fees and exacerbating an already bad situation. I don't know that I agree with that policy, but I think it's arguable that's what that statute's expressing. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that it is arguable. The word is there, so it must mean something. And I think that the Detweiler case does a good job of explaining how the purpose for putting that in there, because often a contempt occurs later in a case. It's not the first thing that happens in a case. Usually there's an order that's issued some point during the case, and then there's a violation of that order giving rise to contempt. And I think that the incentive to parties before that was in was to try to get all of their fees under the contempt statute that they incurred to the entire case. So they added the incurred word, as Detweiler stated. You can only get fees under the contempt statute that are related to the contempt or as a result of
it. But it's a penalty for contempt. You can be put in jail for 25 days. You can pay a fine not exceeding 500, and then they added in 2005 this fee provision. But they're all under the heading of contempt. So are we adding to the penalties by augmenting the contractual-based fee that the party agreed to pay and probably has paid if it's a monthly billing arrangement? Do we have authority to do that?
I get what you're saying. Does it, by, let me rephrase so I make sure I understand, that you're saying that if the Lodestar is used and a higher rate is awarded, that would be an additional penalty under the contempt
statute. Exactly. That's my question.
Yeah. I don't know that I have the answer to that, to be honest with the court. I think that the whole purpose of the contempt statute is to penalize for violating court orders, and we certainly have that situation here, as this court affirmed the contempt order.
Well, counsel,
a previous case. Yes.
Isn't this provision, this particular part that we're talking about in 22.100 sub 3, about holding harmless so that party shouldn't, having successfully found another party in contempt of a court order, they shouldn't be held harmless from any expenses, including fees, that they've had to incur to accomplish that and hold them in contempt. But if we award more fees than they've actually incurred and paid, then they're actually getting like some sort of additional damages rather than just being held harmless. Isn't that right?
It could be read that way, Your Honor. I will say that this court has previously approved the use of the Lodestar method in the context of the contempt statute.
But have we ever approved using it for more than what was actually incurred and paid by the party?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'm sorry, it's hard because we're in two different places.
Sorry.
Isn't the reasonableness analysis, the Brunzell factors that we're all extremely familiar with and use them routinely, isn't all of that designed to analyze whether the fees that were actually incurred and are being sought are reasonable or not?
I believe that the Lodestar case law is aimed at arriving at a reasonable fee based upon the prevailing market rate. And I think that is good policy because it acts as an equalizer. You have situations where you have both high billers and low billers. You have situations where, as we've demonstrated through the number of cases that have been cited by both sides, there's a wide variety of fee arrangements that are entered into between client and counsel across the country. It's really only limited by imagination. But when we're talking about shifting fees, the Lodestar acts as a way to reduce the amount of litigation that's needed because it cuts to the chase. It eliminates the amount of analysis that needs to be done because it goes to what is the prevailing market rate for an attorney of comparable skill and experience within the district where the case is located. And it allows the judge to, based upon that evidence, to evaluate, based upon their experience with that attorney in the case, what is your experience level, what is your skill level, and what is a reasonable market rate for this attorney, despite what the fee agreement might be between client and counsel. And so you can imagine there's situations where an attorney could have, let's say that for the sake of argument, based upon the skill and experience of that attorney, a prevailing market rate would be $400 per hour. You could have an attorney who charges $600 an hour. which is more than the prevailing market rate, for a variety of reasons. Perhaps there's time limitations. It's an undesirable case. But the losing party in a fee-shifting situation shouldn't be penalized because the client agreed to pay a higher rate. It also cuts the other direction. Let's say that that same attorney enters into a fee agreement to take $200 per hour because they're friends with the party, or they see that there's a need there.
Well, counsel?
The district court, yes.
Sorry, I believe it's the history, and I realize there's a long history of this litigation. It's my understanding that there were previous fee awards in this case that have been affirmed, I think, by this court, if I'm correct, that used a lower rate than were approved by the court for this award. So my question is, did something change about what a reasonable rate is between those prior awards and this award, or what? Why should this award be based on a different reasonable rate than the prior awards for a reasonable rate?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I want to say in answer to your question. One is that I think that there's been a misstatement as to what is in the record. The amounts that my firm has charged to other clients in other situations are never part of the record and never developed in evidence. All that we have here in this record is what was charged to these clients. Those prior fee awards that, yes, were affirmed by this court were based upon fees incurred several years ago. And so there's a time issue here where there's been additional time. Obviously, markets change, and it is quite customary for fees to go up from year to year. And so during the course of this case, there was no change in the hourly rate. And there were reasons for that, but then again, that wasn't developed in the record. The court didn't inquire as to the circumstances and negotiations between my client and my firm as to the fees that would be paid. All that was presented to the court was, here's our billing statements that were submitted. You can clearly see the hourly rate. And we provided evidence of the prevailing market rate, which the court considered. And we provided a discussion of the Brinzell factors about the skill and experience of the attorneys that had appeared before the district court. And the district court made its decision in a finding of fact that, in fact, the rates charged in this case were below market. And based upon the Lodestar case law, where he says, look, I'm supposed to find the prevailing market rate, and that's the multiplier. He applied that. There's been no case that has said that the Lodestar is limited to the fee agreement. There have been cases from other jurisdictions which are non-binding, which have been cited by the other side, where they've discussed the fee agreement and they've discussed the rate actually charged. But there's also cases that are also non-binding that we've provided where the court has said, I don't care what the fee agreement says or what was actually charged. The Lodestar is the equalizer. It allows the court to determine the prevailing market rate and to apply that as the multiplier.
But aren't a lot of those cases, and I haven't had a chance to read all of them, obviously, but it seems that two things may distinguish many of those cases. One, they do not have literal language like we have here that tethers it to incurred by the party. And two, they may have a more policy-driven and affirmatively articulated basis for that the lawyer took that case either on a pro bono basis or on a deeply discounted or even moderately discounted basis because, as you said, it was a friend or they felt that the case had been long running and they wanted to give this client a break, whatever the reason. I don't see that as part of the affirmative fee application here. I get that the district court judge took it into that arena a bit by saying your firm's work is excellent and under market. The judge wanted to make a difference. But I don't think we would be ruling in this case on all times that under the Lodestar they might want to augment what is reasonable over what may have been actually paid historically in the case. But this case has this statute and this setting. So can you comment on that? I apologize for the long question.
I'm not sure I understood everything, but I'll do my best. I do want to remind the court that there were actually two bases for the award of fees. The statute was one under the contempt statute, NRS 22.100, but there was also an award of fees under the CCNRs that were underlying the litigation, which would not have that incurred issue. And so if the court is hesitant to make a bright line rule as to what that incurred word means, it can affirm based upon the award under the CCNRs. And I think that that is, I think that's reasonable. I think that the incurred word is related to, as I said before, I think it's related to a time limitation. I don't believe that it was intended to state that you use what's in the fee agreement and only what's in the fee agreement, because as there was a question asked before, well, what happens if in a contempt issue, you have a client who bills at a greatly reduced rate or a pro bono issue? Well, they haven't incurred the fees. Certainly the Legal Aid Center doesn't incur market rate fees. And so if you eliminate that ability, then you cut off a valid method for coming, determining a reasonable fee. I believe that the Lodestar is the guiding light of fee-shifting jurisprudence for a reason, as the Supreme Court has said, and as this court has quoted. Because it allows the court to set a reasonable fee without having to delve into a whole bunch of extraneous issues and multiplying the litigation. And it's fair to both sides. And for those reasons, we respectfully request that the court affirm the decision of the district court. I do have a few minutes. If you want to ask me any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I have a question. With regard to the idea that we have here where there's a rate that's negotiated with the client, it's being paid, what kind of weight do you think the district court should afford to that in making a decision?
I think it should be considered. I think in every case, the court should ask the question, well, what are you actually charging? What's the fee arrangement? I don't think that's unreasonable.
Would you agree with something like Crescent Publishing saying that should be a significant factor in the court's decision? Even if we're not inclined to set a ceiling, should it be a significant factor? And what I'm getting at is my sense of the district court order was that it had short shrift at best. It just said you billed under market rate, and so I'm going to find that a reasonable rate is this. It doesn't seem like that had it had little to no significance to the district court in making its decision.
I would, based upon my experience with the district court and drafting that order and all of that, I would say that the court did consider the rates being charged. It felt like in this circumstance, based upon the time of the case and the length and the work being done and the success that we had, that he felt that it was a too low of a rate. And so I am out of time. Can I finish my answer?
Yes, of course.
I think that the crux of this is that the fee agreement should not have so much weight that it essentially does away with the Lodestar. Because if the fee agreement is controlling and it has so much weight, then what's the point of the Lodestar analysis? Why even look at prevailing market rates? Because the fee agreement would be the answer at all times. That's what you agree to. That's, as they've said, that's the free market, and so that's it. The Lodestar analysis in the case law would be superfluous. It apparently was created for a reason, and I think that the reason is because that the fee agreement, while it does play a factor, it's not the deciding factor.
Go ahead, please.
And I want to go back a little bit to Justice Kadish's questions about the rate that was charged previously and what was requested here, and as it ties into Mr. Smith's statement in the beginning about the policy of this. My understanding was that in 81689, you took the position in your papers at the district court that the law firm's hourly rate of $260 per hour are reasonable. And I understand there's some time change, but that was in 2020, and then you're incurring the fees over the next couple of years, and you go before the court here and request, almost in some areas, $200 more per hour. And seemingly making statements about the length of this litigation and your belief in the frivolity of things that were occurring and trying to bring an end to it. So what is the policy of requesting that much more? And isn't it almost punitive above the punitive idea, penalty idea of fees in the first place?
I don't believe that it was punitive, Your Honor. And I don't believe that it was excessive. As you've said, there was a number of factors that went into the original fee agreement. I could stand here and tell you what those are, but I'd be testifying, and I don't want to do that. And it's not in evidence. And if the court wants that to be developed, I guess it could remand for the district court to go through that analysis. But ultimately, there's the whole idea of, I think that the Lodestar does, is it looks to what is the prevailing rate in the community, and could this attorney in another situation go and obtain a client paying that rate? And that's what creates the fairness of it. That's what creates the equalizer. And I believe that's why it's the guiding light. And I would respectfully request that the court allow the Lodestar to stay in place for both contempt and for contractual, because it can be applied in a number of situations, as we've seen from all the case law. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Thank you. Yeah. Justice Kadish, do you have any further questions?
No, thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Your Honors.
Julie, could you please add 2 minutes to this Mr. Smith's time to equalize the time between them?
I've added the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. All right, so let me first address this issue of their rates in other cases not being part of the record. It's the fee applicant's burden to establish the reasonable rate, and we've invited them multiple times to provide that information to see if perhaps this was a discounted rate, if they've ever charged any other client anything higher than this. They've repeatedly declined to do so. That's their waiver, not ours. And speaking of waiver, again, in the answering brief, they never sought to make any sort of distinction between the analysis of fees under 22.100 and Section 25 of the CCNRs. I don't think it's appropriate now to say that, oh, well, the analysis would be different. They had every opportunity to raise that before. Getting to the point about Hensley, the point that I strongly agree with, that the fee litigation should not turn into a second litigation. Respectfully, I don't think that this is a problem of the Lidl's making. They've, in fact, released the bond to the extent of the undisputed amount. All we're talking now is about the excess above their billed rates. It just seems to us that they're the ones encouraging litigations by seeking fees above freely negotiated market rates. All right, so again, getting to the point about the 260 being affirmed repeatedly in prior litigations, yes, that is a relevant factor. In fact, as the cases say, obviously the best evidence, in fact, Lindy Brothers, the progenitor of Lodestar analysis, says itself, the value of an attorney's time generally is reflected in his normal billing rate or her normal billing rate. So that is the best evidence of market value. Again, under the circumstances where we would expect that to be a free and fair market transaction, and in a lot of cases, that's not the case. That's why there's Lodestar analysis that also looks to community rates. But none of those factors are present in this case. And certainly not, as Justice Herndon pointed out, to the extent of the district court practically ignoring the actual rate in this case. And yes, I understand that counsel drafted the order and included a Brunzell analysis, but Judge Williams was also very clear in his comments after the order, and in the order itself, by the way, that there was no enhancement to the Lodestar. This was purported to be the initial Lodestar calculation itself, with the reasonable hourly rate being this 40%+ markup from actual billed rates. So, again, I don't think that there is an abuse of discretion in that, even if there is, play in the joints with respect to the Lodestar, the enhancement to a Lodestar. There was no enhancement in this case. Let me just get to this point about the penalty aspect of it. I agree. It is a penalty on a penalty when you're talking about already a fee-shifting statute and now adding fees that were not incurred by the party, and more than not incurred. I mean, this is why I'm saying the analysis we're talking about would be true even under a regime like Section 1988 that doesn't have an incurred requirement. You still need to look at what is a market rate for these attorneys, not market rate for other attorneys, not market rate for, you know, attorneys in Las Vegas generally. For these attorneys, the best evidence of that market rate is the bill, is the actual billing rate that they charged in this case, and that was affirmed in this case as a reasonable rate, a rate that they purported, they propounded as a reasonable rate in prior fee applications.
But Mr. Smith, let's assume, so the best evidence is the actual rate charged, but if we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard, then don't we need to rely on the evaluation of the district judge who had this litigation before him, considered all the facts, and, you know, was aware of what the actual rate being charged to the client was and the evidence presented about market rate, and considered all that? How can we say that's an abuse of discretion?
It's an abuse of discretion because it rests on a factual error, what everybody concedes to be a factual error. At least there's no evidence in the record that it's not an error, which is the district court believed this to be a discounted rate. And that was his comment, those were his comments that he invited us to read to the Supreme Court after the order on this matter, saying that he believed this was a just access to justice issue, and that, you know, that attorneys would take some cases, but that there needed to be a markup in order to allow the firm to keep its doors open.
But what if it were? I guess we're going to have to write a disposition here. And under this statute with these words, if it had been a situation where they took the thing and gave them a 50% discount because it had been so long running and so expensive, and said, if we win, we're going to apply for the full amount, would the district court have had authority to do that legally?
No, under the incurred requirement that we talked about. But yes, he could have considered that in the initial lodestar calculation, right? Because Detweiler says that there are two components to that. First, our normal reasonableness analysis, which would be the lodestar calculation. Yes, he could take that into account if there were, in fact, some kind of discounted rate. But then when you get to the incurred, I believe that would impose
a separate limitation. So it's a hard stop on whatever the agreement was, and if they were representing them for free, they couldn't get fees for enforcing that?
Well, not as an award to the party, which is what the contempt statute says. Again, there might be...
So they'd have to go under the contract or 18010 or something?
Right, if there's some other...
But you think this statute doesn't authorize anything other than whatever the agreement is it controls?
That's how I read the words.
Unless the upside is that it's unreasonable, that it's like they're charging $2,000 an hour because it's annoying and has gone on too long.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think you need to reach that more complex question in this case, but yes, that is my answer. My concern is that if this court simply affirms, then there really are no limits on a district court's discretion.
But conversely, how you affirm matters, because there are cases where 1988 being classic, that whole body of law that you want to incentivize people taking cases that otherwise wouldn't get brought.
And I agree, Your Honor, and that's why Section 1988 is about attracting counsel to take a case as opposed to reimbursing somebody for a mid-litigation issue of contempt.
And now I've taken you over your time. My colleagues, Justice Herndon, Justice Kadish, do either of you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
I actually do. I do, sorry.
Okay.
So you were just, in answer to, I think, my question, but maybe one of the others, about that there was a factual error by the court in that the judge believed it to be a discounted rate. I'm looking at the order entered by the court, and in paragraph 6 of the conclusions of law on page 4, the finding in the second sentence is that the court finds that the rates billed by plaintiff's counsel to the plaintiffs are below market. That is, or do you dispute that there's evidence to support that as a finding?
Well, I do, and I recognize how far over my time I am. I do dispute that because, as I mentioned, the analysis under Blum and Cousy is not merely the market, the Las Vegas market. It's the market rate for attorneys of comparable skill and experience. Mm-hmm. And here we have a rate structure that readily explains why their rates are the way they are, because of things like billing for time that would ordinarily be incurred through support staff, et cetera. So I disagree with that finding as well, yes.
So you think that the evidence of fees charged by other attorneys in the market are not comparable because of the unique way that this firm bills and calculates their fees. Is that accurate?
Correct. And also because, I mean, I looked through those cases. As far as I could tell, none of those cases involved the kind of litigation that we're talking about here. There were personal injury cases. There was a sexual battery case. There was a construction issue. So again, to merely say, oh, well, other attorneys charge this partner rate, associate rate, I don't think is a complete analysis under Cousy.
Justice Herndon has another question.
I have a very quick question, and I apologize. One of the best lessons I learned on this court was from Justice Pickering. When you have a question about what a party wants, ask them to be specific about what it is they're asking you to do. So I know you want us to reverse the judgment. Are you asking us to in some way impose a hard ceiling on a negotiated contract rate to find that that's presumptively reasonable, to find in line with a Crescent Publishing type decision that that's a significant factor and outline how a district court should address it, or simply to reverse the judgment and say it was an abuse of discretion under Nevada law?
Well, as you did yesterday or 2 days ago in Edgeworth versus Danny Simon, you actually did undertake that analysis yourself and said, we're not going to send it back to district court. We're just reversing. We're saying it's 38,000, not 200,000. I think that actually would be appropriate because there is no dispute here about whether, you know, what the rate would be if it's actual rates versus the marked up rates. That said, I think it's actually fairly simple because we're not asking the court to impose some kind of hard ceiling. As we stated, there are a number of factors and there might be discretion in assessing those factors, where the court could find that, well, there's a reason why your actual build rate in this case is not a true market rate, right? So the court would have discretion to assess that because of a discount, because of the nature of the case, because of the impecunious nature of the clients, whatever the factors are. There would be discretion in that analysis, but here it is a clean record because there is no such evidence.
Right. Thank you. I believe you're done. I want to thank all